This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Hi there and welcome to our August 2018 episode. I'm Dave, the magazine's production editor, and I'm joined in the studio today by editor Chris.
Hello.
And news editor Ezzy.
Hello.
Coming up later in this episode, we'll be talking to meteor shower expert and meteorite hunter, Dr. Peter Jenniskens, and telling you our top stargazing tip for the month. But now, we're going to take a look at what's hot in the August edition of the magazine. Chris, what's caught your eye?
Well, Dave, this month I was really interested in our Passion for Space column, which has been written by Dr. Andrew Steele. Now, he's a senior staff scientist at the Carnegie Institute in Washington, D.C., and he's an astrobiologist, and he's one of the key people behind the recent discovery of organics on Mars by using Curiosity data. And it's really interesting to get the insight from him behind all the research that went into it and the kind of all the data crunching, which what it sounds like from his column, that went into the discovery.
It does sound a bit like, to the layman on the outside, it sounds like we've been looking for life on Mars for ages, and now they seem to be redefining what life is to prove that there's life on Mars. I mean, is that what's going on?
What he's saying in the column, actually, is that there needs to be... he needs to establish certain kind of baseline for what kind of chemistry looks like when it's not to do with any life, or this kind of so-called abiotic chemistry, what that looks like, before you can then go on and say, well, these molecules look slightly different. Do they look like, are they the kind of things that might be kind of the precursors to life or prebiotic kind of stuff?
What was it that the Curiosity actually found on?
It was carbon molecules, which were very big, which were kind of strings of these kind of compounds strung together, which looked like or contained compounds that that looked like kind of life on Earth, basically.
So organic chemistry.
Yes, organic chemistry, yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating to hear from him as well, because it's kind of... astrobiology has always been a kind of one of the more kind of esoteric branches of astronomy, and it's not really had much kind of grounding before. And he's one of the people who is really trying to put it on a really secure footing, and kind of establish these things for something that it's going to be quite tricky to find life, which might not even look like life on Earth anyway. So how do you do that?
You might not know what to look for, even.
Yeah, I know that's one of those things that most people, as soon as they hear the words organic chemistry, they automatically think it's like, oh, well, it's going to be, you know, like plant matter and, you know, like they found compost on Mars. But actually, there's all sorts of ways that you can get these organic compounds.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
I think it's really interesting to find out what that is.
It kind of puts a new spin on War of the Worlds, though, doesn't it? With the chances of anything coming from Mars are 1,000,000 to 1. But, like, maybe they've just been coming here for centuries on meteorites and stuff.
Yes, exactly.
That's one of those big theories, is like life actually started somewhere else and came on a meteor.
Yeah. Well, actually, one of the things that is interesting is that Andrew Steele says in the column is that they found they used a Martian meteorite that fell to Earth to set up the kind of baseline for looking then for these other compounds, molecules that were lifelike or biological. Yeah.
Blimey, it gets a bit existential, doesn't it?
Yeah.
A short column, but there's lots to consider from it. It's amazing. Yeah.
Mind-blowing. Yeah. Right, well, I've been... one of the other features that really caught my eye, just because it's full of great science fiction-y type concepts, is that we've got a feature on the future of space telescopes. Swinging off on the fact that after the 2030s, we just won't be able to get bigger and bigger and bigger traditional telescopes launched from Earth. They just won't fit in the spacecraft.
Or be having to fold them.
Yeah, concertinas and all this kind of... They're using a lot of origami, aren't they, to work out the most efficient way to fold mirrors.
Yeah, they've got one that looks like an umbrella that's like sort of pops out. Actually, it looks more like a jellyfish if you look at them. The diagram we've got in the magazine does look like a jellyfish breeding ground or something. But,
jellyfish in space. That's a sci-fi novel waiting to happen.
are these alternatives to the kind of Newtonian telescope with mirrors in space? Are these alternatives in construction now? Are they, or how far away are we?
There's two types of way to go. There's a way of like trying to keep the Newtonian idea, but just, as we say, concertina it, scrunching it up, which could take us the next stage. But then beyond that, there are weird, like, lensless telescopes being developed, you know, like, which apparently can read barcodes from the moon, which is, like, great if you want to do your Asda shopping, but, you know.
I suppose that'd be useful for, you know, the people... In future lunar colonies, you know, they can get their deliveries from home and their self-service from the moon.
they are actually, as far as I understand, they're not in construction yet, but they are, they're forming the next basis for, there's a big meeting. The NASA 2020 Astrophysics Decadal, I presume that's how you say, survey, a lot of the ideas have been pitched there, and I think they're going to be choosing a couple, maybe one or a couple, that they will actually take forward. And might be their big project for the 2030s. So they're definitely seriously considering them now. Some of them are in prototype stage. Actually, yeah, the barcode reader from space, they built a prototype of that, but they had to do some very clever thing with mirrors to approximate it looking from space, apparently. They managed to get some results with that. So, these things are underway.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. I find it amazing that... The Newtonian design has lasted us so well and for so long. You know, when was it developed? Newton developed in the 17th century, didn't he? I think it says, doesn't it, that he would recognise the Hubble Space Telescope or the JWST if he saw it.
If you actually look at the Hubble telescope, it's got big wings on because it's got solar panels, but it's essentially the same telescope that, you know, you'd have in your garage. Yeah. In your back garden, it's...
But also the umbrella just reminded me, the umbrella one that we talked about earlier, which would be a Newtonian, but like on fire like an umbrella, it's got one of the best acronyms ever. It's actually called a precisely extremely large reflective telescope using reconfigurable elements. Blimey. Which somehow they've managed to make that come to aperture.
I do sometimes wonder how much of sort of the time they're spent developing telescopes is spent on coming up with a really good acronym.
Yes. quite often they're backronyms, so they're not acronyms, are they? They come up with the cool words to start off the scene. How can we fill that out a little bit? But yeah, it takes a long time to do that as well.
Izzy, what caught your eye in this issue?
So this month I've been going deep into the world of meteor observing, and sort of looking. Like, it's usually one of those things that most people, when they start in astronomy, it's one of the first things they do, go out and see the Perseids, which will be very good this month. But how do you sort of take that to the next level? And so I talked to lots of people from the BAA and from various different meteor hunting things, finding all about, you know, how you can observe things visually, how you can set up a camera in your garden. So that was pretty cool. But I think one of the things that really interested me was the fact that you can find micrometeorites. So this is the sort of space dust that falls to Earth that doesn't quite completely burn up, and you can find it in your gutters at home. I actually gave it a go. I wasn't terribly successful. but it was quite...
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Oh, flight again.
Yeah, so I got a couple of funny looks as I was sort of standing on a stepladder with my a magnet in a plastic bag in my gutters, trying
because that's how the guy does it. That's how the guy does it, isn't it? With magnets inside a plastic bag.
Yes.
And why the plastic bags?
So it's basically, it's so that you can get the meteorites off. You're looking for tiny magnetic metal particles. And if stuff sticks to a magnet, it can be quite hard to get it off again. So you get the plastic bags, you can just take the magnet out of the plastic bag, and then you have a bunch of metal particles. It was done by a man called John Larson. He was a musician, and he sort of was doing this kind of meteorite hunting in his spare time between gigs, essentially. And he was like getting people in Oslo, because he's Norwegian, to send him boxes of their gutter. Like, sort of, if you've cleaned out your gutters, can you please send me a box of the stuff? And he worked out this sort of very sort of rigorous procedure of trying to find it. And now there's people all over the world who have been trying to do this and managing to find these tiny little grains of meteorite and sending them off and getting identified and then they're often... scientists getting a hold of them and things. So I think that's quite cool if there's lots of people. You can actually sort of find something like that in your own home and then send
that's
it
incredible,
off.
Incredible, isn't it? Yeah. How do you have to, if you've got something that's metallic, is that it if it sticks to the magnet, is it a meteorite?
No,
Do you have to do a little bit else?
So this is one of the reasons why it took a while to sort of get people to work out how to do it is because if you're in an urban environment, so in a town, then there's all kinds of pollution that's around that all have like tiny little metallic particles. And apparently, so one of the last sort of things you do is once you've got all of your metallic stuff and you've cleaned it and you've put it through a sieve, and then you look at it under a microscope. And then apparently meteorites are very distinctive because they tend to be quite spherical. They've sometimes got a bit of glass on them because they got very, very hot. So silica on there turns to glass. And so they're quite distinctive as soon as you get them under a microscope. But yes, it's one of the reasons why it can be a bit tricky to find them in the first place is because there's just so much other stuff around.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I tell you, I had my gutters cleaned recently. I'm like, oh, goodness me. There's like plants growing out of it. It's terrible. Yeah.
There might be Martian plants, you know.
Maybe.
Yeah. So didn't somebody actually... find a slightly bigger meteorite recently?
Yes, they did. So another thing that people do when they're observing meteors coming in, they quite often have cameras and stuff. And one of the sort of big goals of people watching for meteors with cameras is trying to actually recover a meteorite when it comes in. And yes, a group managed to do that in Botswana back in June of this year. And I actually caught up with one of the leaders of that expedition, Peter Jeniskens. I'm talking to Peter Jeniskens, a meteor astronomer from the SETI Institute. On the 2nd of June, a meteorite fell on the Botswana Central Game Reserve, which Peter Jeniskens went out to go and find. So, Peter, could you tell me a little bit about people find meteorites all the time? What was so special about this particular find?
Well, what was so special was that this little asteroid had been spotted in space before it impacted. And so it was tracked for a short period of time, and it was observed by astronomers. And we have a lot of asteroids out there that never hit the Earth, that passes by, that we only get to look at with telescopes. And so to have a chance to actually find a piece of one of these asteroids and link the astronomy with actual data you can study in the laboratory is fantastic.
How was the meteorite found whilst it was still out in space?
There are ongoing surveys of asteroids to find the ones that could be dangerous impacting us. We like to know where they are. We like to measure their tracks in space. These surveys are being done at telescope sites such as the Carolina Sky Survey in Arizona, the Atlas Project in Hawaii, and there's a few more. They point the telescopes at the sky, they take pictures, and they look for things moving, a little point of light that moves between the stars. They track these point of light, and that way they are able to determine what their orbit is around the sun.
And once you'd seen the meteor that was out in space, when it hit the Earth's atmosphere, how did you then know whereabouts to look to try and find a piece of it?
To know where to look to find a piece of it, that was the challenge here, because this asteroid wasn't tracked very long. It impacted the Earth only 8 hours after it was first spotted. And so we had some information to go on, but we needed to try and confine the position. So what I did is I teamed up with Oliver Moses of the University of Botswana at Moon, Okavango's Research Institute, and with Oliver we traveled through the region and went to places to see if we could find video security cameras that accidentally recorded this fireball. And we found some in Rekops, which is to the east of the impact site, and also in Naun, which is to the north. And from those videos, we were basically looking for shadows cast by the fireball. And so from the direction of the shadows, we could determine where exactly this object had disintegrated.
So it was from the shadows rather than actually looking sort of on the sky directly for the fireball itself?
Yes, the fireball is so bright that if you see it from sides that close up, it just blooms the camera. The most video security cameras are also pointed down or inside buildings, and so. But the shadows are very nice to determine directions.
And so, when you had a rough idea of whereabouts it fell, what was sort of the next stage? How did you actually go out and go about finding it?
Yeah, so the next step is to realize that when a small asteroid comes in the atmosphere and it meets its end, it catastrophically breaks apart into many pieces. All those pieces fall to the ground in the ambient winds, and so the atmosphere is blowing the pieces off course. And so you have to calculate what those wind speeds are at, you know, between the ground level and the altitude where this thing disrupted. And so we were able to get data from Jesse Atting and Lasse Evers of the Royal Dutch Meteorological Institute, and they provided me with a nice wind profile for models. And from that, I calculated where on the ground these meteorites should have fallen. Okay, so now we had a place to go, but it still then needs a lot of people to actually have a chance to find something.
From what I know about Botswana terrain, it's not particularly... There's lots of greenery and things around. Was it particularly hard to sort of track down one rock amongst a bunch of other rocks?
Yes, it was hard to track down this one rock. We were very lucky in a way. The search campaign came together from three institutes that participated in this. The lead was taken by the Botswana International University of Science and Technology, which brought a team of five people in the field. It was led by the Botswana Geosciences Institute, who brought a team of three people. And Oliver took two people and himself into the field. So we had about 12 people searching, also with support from the Central Kalahari Game Reserve Park Rangers. And even with 12 people, we walked around for a long distance and initially just could not find meteorites. The terrain is searchable. It's sort of sandy. It's sandy terrain with tufts of grass. But there is so much vegetation that you really can't look beyond just a few meters from where you're walking. And so finding large pieces is very hard. And so we concentrated on looking for the small pieces. And but that meant, you know, going into the wild for 12 kilometers, setting up camp in the savanna, and you know, and searching.
But well, you got lucky, and you tracked down this meteorite. So what will happen to it now?
So one meteorite was found, and that is just the beginning of this project. It's really just the beginning, because the next step is going to be to try and figure out what it is, what its collisional history is with, in sort of what environment it was formed, and how it evolved and how it made it to the Earth. And all of that is going to be, you know, a real detective puzzle. So we're hoping that a lot of people will have a chance to study this and learn a lot about it.
Well, Peter, thank you very much for taking the time out to talk to us. That was, I'm really looking forward to hearing more about this meteorite and hearing more information about where it came from and all those sorts of things. So thank you for taking us through the beginning of that journey.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Peter Jenniskens. Find out more about how you can search for micrometeorites yourself in August's issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine.
There's loads to see in the night sky this month, which you can find out all about in our guide to the night sky in the August issue. But if there's one thing you really should see, it's the Perseids. Now, this is a reliably substantial meteor shower, one of the year's biggest, which in 2018 coincides with a new moon, so the sky will be nice and dark and any meteors will be easy to spot. The time to watch is between the 9th and the 16th of August, and with a peak of activity on the night of the 12th to the 13th. To observe the Perseids, the best thing to do is find a dark location away from stray lights, grab something to sit on, preferably a sunbed if you've got one, so you're nice and comfortable, and start looking up at the sky at an angle of around 60 degrees. Any direction is good, but we'd probably recommend looking south earlier in the evening and east later in the night towards dawn. Bring plenty of warm drinks or soup to keep the spirits up until the magical moment when you see your first meteor. At the peak, you should see about 30 to 35 meteors an hour, and although the rate of meteors increases after 1 a.m, there should still be trails visible earlier in the evening.
So, that's it from us this month. You can find out more about meteor observing in the August issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we also test out a Ritchie Christian imaging telescope, a go-to mount especially for solar observing, and a specialist deep sky camera. Look at how space telescopes could go on getting bigger and bigger. Hear what it's like to be a crew member on a Mars analog mission, and have observing and imaging tips from some of the most experienced amateurs in the country. From us all here at BBC Sky at Night magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Fletcher. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com, or simply head to iTunes.